Let's get going. We'll call to order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee of the Oregon Senate. Colleagues, today is Wednesday, February 16th, and we are convened for the purposes of an informational meeting regarding the drivers of the cost of health care. And later on in the session, we will introduce a number of committee bills, one of which is still on the way. I apologize that we will be introducing one that we weren't able to get to you beforehand. So, to tee this up for people who may be sitting in on this committee for the first time, we've had a fair amount of testimony about the ways that the health insurance rate review process might be improved to help keep insurance premiums low. And we wanted to hear from the rest of the parts of the health care system so that we can understand all of the different trends that are affecting premiums. So that being said, I would like to now bring up our first presenter. That would be Leanne Gassaway, the Senior Regional Director for State Affairs with America's Health Insurance Plans. Ms. Gassaway.
Thank you, Chairman Shields and Vice Chair George and members of the committee. Thank you for having me to testify today on this important subject. AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, represents about 1,300 health insurance companies nationwide that cover over 200 million Americans, and we participate not only in the commercial insurance business but also in public programs and have a commitment to public health as well. We have been talking about costs and cost drivers continuously for the last several years and are very pleased to be here today to address it with this committee. You have a packet in front of you which has several slides that I've tried to highlight some of the issues that we'll be going over today.
Yep.
And what I would like to talk about first is that if you look at kind of how we're spending healthcare dollars as a nation, the first slide entitled Where Have Costs Soared? Gives you a glimpse of the total healthcare spending that's going on for all healthcare services in the United States and the growth in billions over the last 10 years. And as you can see, all sectors have increased: hospital, public health, research, physician, prescription drugs, except with the exception of administration. And I just wanted to highlight that the percentage of premiums towards administrative costs had actually declined for the sixth consecutive year in a row, starting at about 14% in 2003 and going down to about 11% by 2009. And the next slide kind of points out some key sectors of the national health expenditure data, showing increases for prescription drugs, physician, total health spending, average increase, as well as hospital and administrative costs. And you can see kind of a comparison there about where are we seeing some of the most activity in cost-driving behavior. On this particular slide, I will point out prescription drugs, which I think in the 90s we had some success in getting our hands around prescription drug costs with a lot of movement towards the generic and more formulary management techniques. We now are seeing huge increases again in the prescription drug arena, just in the last 9 years increasing over 104% year over year. So a lot of increases going on there. In terms of premium and benefit growth, the federal government data produced by CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has national data that over the last 10 years shows that the benefit growth and the premium growth have actually stayed about the same, just a little bit around 75%. And this trend is probably the most important to see, that it's underlying medical costs that we need to address as a stakeholder community, and it's unsustainable at this point. We need to address it as a group. The next several slides are for background, just to give you some comparison of where the U.S. stands in comparison to other nations in terms of our healthcare spendings on certain types of services, so CT scans, the normal delivery of a baby, and the average cost per day. And as you can see, when you look at the numbers, there is a large deviation of where the U.S. is spending dollars as compared to the other developed nations: Canada, France, Germany, Netherlands, Spain, the U.K., and even Medicare. as a comparison bar there on your graph. So just some comparison data there. I won't go into too much about that because it's not always an apples-to-apples comparison, but it's instructive to see that in the U.S. we are spending more than other nations for a variety of reasons. The next several slides are probably where I want to spend most of my time today. AHIP produced a cost hospital report in December of 2010 using great data that was actually produced right here in Oregon and in California. Oregon and California are a little bit unique where they have a public database that's collecting hospital charge data. And this database is robust enough, and in Oregon it's been collecting data since 2005, and in California it's been collecting data since 2000, so over 10 years of data now exists in California. And it allows us to really get a glimpse of what is going on one particular sector, not all sectors, but in one sector. And that report, it was not meant to point a finger or create a villain. It really is about trying to get an understanding of what is happening in one particular sector and see if that's instructed in other sectors. By taking that Oregon data, what we found is looking at nine particular kind of run-of-the-mill, if you will, services that are performed, like a normal delivery, a hysterectomy, pneumonia, a normal delivery, hip joint replacement, appendectomy. How have costs increased over the last 4 years? And this chart that you have in front of you shows you that for some of those services, the least amount of increase for balloon angioplasty without a heart attack had a 38% increase in dollars from 2005 to 2009. And then the highest was a normal delivery, which increased 69% over 4 years. And that is instructive in terms of understanding that there are cost increases going on in this sector where a lot of healthcare dollars are being paid. If you look at the overall pie of healthcare spending, hospitals consume about 33% of that pie, physicians take about another 33%, and the other 33% is divvied up amongst drugs and DME and home health and administrative costs, et cetera. So if we have 33% of our healthcare pie that's being driven by this kind of price increase, you can see how that's affecting the rest of the healthcare spending going on. This chart, one thing that's lacking here is the utilization data. So what this is just showing is the unit price. So how much are we actually paying for a given service year over year? What we're not seeing behind that is the increase in utilization. So how many more services are we giving because of a number of factors, and I'll go into that a little bit later. But it's easy to say, okay, just the costs are going up, and so if we just push the cost down, that's fine. But there's a whole other set of variables that are also pushing costs up. I would be incredibly remiss if I did not address cost shifting within our healthcare system. The next slide is actually using the California data to demonstrate what is happening amongst different payer sources and different government programs. Using 10 years worth of data, you can see from the report that in 10 years, Medi-Cal, which is their Medicaid program, revenue increases only went up 18% in 10 years. And for Medicare, it went up 76% in 10 years. But commercial insurance payments went up 159% payments to hospitals. And so you can see that this is not balanced. There's something wrong here about how we are spending our healthcare dollars. Now, again, this is just focused on hospitals, but this same dynamic is happening in other sectors of our healthcare system. It is happening in physicians. It is happening in pharmaceuticals. It is happening in every other sector as well. But this just gives you a glimpse of what we can see with the data that we have available to us. And the inadequacy of payments from public programs and the continued burden of uncompensated care is shifted onto the private insurance segment. Two additional studies to note. In December 2008, a Milliman study came out and said that the average family of four is paying a hidden tax of $1,700 per year because of cost shifts from payments, underpayments being made to hospitals and physicians. In May 2009, Families USA also released a study that said cost shift from uncompensated care adds more than $1,000 annually to family premiums. So that's also attributing to premium increases because of how this cost shift is being worked out within the delivery system. The next slide is kind of shows you a bigger picture of a lot of change and pressures that are being put around the system that are leading to increasing costs. There's a couple on this that I'd like to point out. One is demographic changes and lifestyle behaviors. We know that as we have lifestyle choices that we make every day, and we know and watch the public health trends to know that we are growing more unhealthy as a society, especially in the area around childhood obesity and obesity in general, and that is leading to an increase in utilization. So if we go back to that first slide where it shows there's an increase in cost going up, other things are contributing that we're having to use more of those services more often than we used to because of the way that we are living and the lifestyle behaviors that are contributing to that. As a population, we are aging. As much as we may want to fight it, we are aging, and as the baby boomers come into the Medicare arena, that is going to exacerbate the problem in the Medicare problem about costs because of the fact that you have a lot of folks who are living longer, which is great, but it also adds more additional pressure on healthcare costs in general. Provider consolidation and our bias towards new and expensive technologies is changing the unit price. So not only that gets to how much we're paying for that one unit, that one widget of service. 2008 National Health Expenditure Data Report showed that price increases constitutes two-thirds of the year-over-year increase in health spending. So that is the unit price, and that's for a number of reasons. Just to give you some examples of what's happening around unit price, provider consolidation has been one contributing factor to that, and we have seen that in a lot of markets, not pointing out any here, particularly in Oregon. But an AHIP member reported that a must-have hospital demanded a 40% increase in payment and insisted in contractual terms that it would prohibit the plan from sharing the facility's quality information with consumers. It's a must-have hospital, they get their price, and you can't even give quality data about that facility to the patient. That's kind of what market dominance can do. In terms of the cost shift, an AHIP member reported that a hospital in suburban New Jersey, the only hospital in that community, demanded that the health plan pay an extra 15% to 16% to compensate for Medicaid and Medicare underpayments that were rising at 4% to 5% less than the hospital's actual costs. In terms of unit cost, charges for a colonoscopy vary widely amongst three hospitals in a 20-mile radius in California with no apparent linkage to quality, with the minimum typical price ranging from $2,100 to $3,700, with a maximum typical price being between $2,500 and $4,100. So mass price variance with no linkage to quality for a single same service. And then out-of-network issues. In August 2009, AHIP released a survey on out-of-network fees and found that a patient in Arizona was charged $72,000 for lower back spinal fusion when Medicare would have paid $1,683. And for a total hip replacement surgery, a patient was charged over $45,000 when Medicare's fee is $1,431. And a patient in California was charged over $15,000 for cataract surgery, where Medicare pays $638. In addition to just all of those dynamics of an opaque system that's outdated that we need to bring into the 21st century through administrative simplification and a number of other things, reforming our medical liability system, addressing cost shift in a real way, including having states and the federal government step up on that, and really addressing medical liability reform. We have a number of things that are kind of sitting out on the horizon that I just want to call to the attention around federal reform. Our companies are committed to implementing federal reform under the Affordable Care Act in a constructive and successful way. But we do want to raise a little bit of a notice to several provisions that will increase costs come January 1st. Under the ACA, there's very little to address these underlying medical costs that we've just talked about right now. In addition, the definition of what will be a minimum essential benefits plan, which may or may not, depending on the definition, expand coverage obligations and increase the price of affordability of insurance moving forward. There is a premium sales tax, which will hit about $8 billion worth for January 1st in 2014, and that increases to over $13 billion by January 1st, 2019. There is an age rating tightening that will be coming to the individual and small group markets, will disproportionately affect younger workers. And because of the Medicare and Medicaid cuts that are in the bill, there will be even more cost shifting that is expected to come out of the federal reform, and we need to address that head on. Lastly, about what can we do? There are a number of ideas to address rising costs, but it will take hard work by all stakeholders to do that. We need to achieve real transparency on cost and quality so patients can be empowered and doctors can make the best decisions for those patients with information available. Today, we have a very hidden system, and we need to address that. We need to increase coordination of care, and a lot of that activity is going to be taking place through a variety of pilot programs, accountable care organizations, medical home projects, and we need to see more of that, especially around patients with chronic conditions. We need to start paying doctors and hospitals for quality and value, not on volume. We need to advance and embrace evidence-based medicine throughout the entire system, and we need to promote prevention and wellness to address the lifestyle issue. We need to reform the medical liability system to protect providers who practice evidence-based medicine, and we need to transform our healthcare administration through a national platform that's uniform across all states to improve efficiency, reduce medical errors, and enable providers to focus on care. So that in conclusion, thanks for having me today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Senator Monroe.
Prescription drugs, your first slide showed they've gone up 104% in the last 9 years. I'm wondering why that is. Why are prescription drugs so much more expensive in the United States than they are, for example, in Canada? And does the fact that about 3 out of every 4 advertisements I see on my television are for prescription drugs that ostensibly people can't get without a prescription from their doctor, and yet they advertise these in lengthy advertisements, most of which are taken up by telling us what might happen if we take this drug, bad things. Are those in any way related to those excessive costs?
Chairman Shields and Senator Monroe, I think you've asked an incredibly important question. I think there are a number of reforms that need to be addressed within the way that we regulate pharmaceuticals today. There are a ton of direct-to-consumer advertising. Additionally, as I had mentioned in my testimony, we actually saw a slowing of prescription drug costs in the 90s and have since not seen that. And a lot of it is because of ramped-up direct-to-consumer advertising, another bias towards brand-name drugs. And more importantly, what we're seeing of late is coupons where pharmaceutical companies will send you a coupon to essentially eliminate your cost share for maybe the first month or two. And then, of course, when you are stabilized on that medication, you go to try to get it at your cost share through your medical plan, mm-hmm. and realize it's either off formulary or has an incredibly high cost associated with it when maybe a generic or older, better drug was more appropriate. And so I think we do have some reforms to address with the way that pharmaceuticals are treated in the United States. I can't comment on how price controls are done in other nations. I mean, that's one reason why other nations have a lower tab for prescription drugs, is there is some cost controls that are done by government purchasing. And in our own government, our government gets the best price. And so in the private sector, we have to also make up for that. Medicaid gets the best price for drugs than any other buyer. That is part of the cost shift problem, is that governments, because they are a huge purchaser of healthcare services, get the best pricing.
Follow up. But aren't there restrictions on Medicare getting drugs from Canada?
Chairman Shields, Senator Monroe, yes. I believe the federal law prohibits having drugs coming from other nations being dispensed in the United States. Purchased outside of the United States.
Is there any evidence that those drugs in Canada are somehow less safe than the ones in the United States?
Chairman Shields, Senator Monroe, I don't know the answer to that question. I could certainly investigate that and get back to you on that.
Okay. Because that was the reason for that restriction. They said, well, coming from another country, they might not be safe, but here in the United States, of course, we all know they're all safe. I wonder if there's any real firm evidence to prove that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Leanne, you mentioned in your testimony one of the issues that I've continued to bring up during this is that what's adding the cost of private insurance is this cost-shifting issue that you brought up. You talked about some research that was able to be done in California and Oregon of which information I haven't been able to obtain, which is sort of what the providers are charging to the different clients they may have. So what they're charging to Medicare, what Providence Hospital is charging to Providence Insurance, what all the way through. Where's that data available? Or how do I get a hold of data so I kind of see how, because this cost share issue is very, very interesting to me, because what we regulate is just the private small group plans. And yet they seem to be, from my perspective, the group that continues to be the bearer of the cost shift from everybody else. So since that's who we regulate, I'd like to be able to go back and say, okay, where are these cost shares going from? So far, I haven't been able to get any information about that, and you talked about that. Could you discuss that a little further?
Yes, Chairman Shields and Vice Chair George. OHPR here in Oregon, actually, to my understanding, where the data that was derived for slide 9, which is the by service slide, is derived through reporting that is done from the hospitals here in Oregon directly to the Office of Health Policy and Research. And my understanding is that is done on a service provider and plan basis. So that data, that kind of microscopic granular set of data that you've just described, I believe they have. To the extent that they can roll that up, maybe something, I believe they're on the panel today, and maybe that might be something they might be able to address. But in California, same type of thing. The data is all of there, and we can make these comparisons of how much a provider is getting. What we wouldn't be able to necessarily ascertain from the raw data is how much cost shift is happening. So what we know is how much is the health plans paying for those services, and we know how much Medicare is paying for those services, and we know how much Medicaid is paying for those services. In California, they actually have to also report in what's called a cost to charge data. So it's basically the amount that they need to cover the cost of that service. So I think you may be able to back out some of that data from the California data. I am uncertain if the Oregon data includes that level of specificity. But it's hospital-reported data. It is not health plan-reported data. And so you'd have to put it through some kind of algorithms that are way above my pay grade to get to that. But I think that the raw data is probably there for some really smart people to try to do more of an academic understanding of how the cost shift is actually showing up here in Oregon.
One more, and then we're going to have to move on.
Okay. Real quickly, you talked about the demand for new technology when you were comparing the United States to other countries. Is that a consumer demand? Is that a provider demand? I mean, are the consumers asking for all these extra scans? Is this doctor-driven because they're worried about lawsuits? From the insurance perspective, what drives that higher demand in the U.S. for additional services like scans and who's driving it?
Chairman Shields, Vice Chair George, I think that it's probably a little bit of all of that. I think that in American culture, we have a love of new technology. We embrace it, we love it, and we have a bias towards newer must be better. And within our medical community, they want to be able to meet the demands of patients and be able to give the highest quality of care available. So there is a little bit of both going on to make sure that those facilities are being able to meet the needs of the patients, but also the patients seeing the advertising, seeing, you know, the GE scanner commercials during the PGA Open, you know, it's all there. I mean, so we know as a consumer society that these technologies exist, and so I think there is some consumer demand. There has been documented evidence in the past that if you build it, they do come in the medical community. So if you build a new hospital, it will get full. If you put in a CT scanner, it will get used. And so we do see that there is some evidence out there over time that has shown that as we build them, utilization and costs do go up with that. But what we are lacking and something that we have actually embraced for a long time is this kind of evidence-based medicine protocol, which is we need better evidence to not just know does something work, but does it work better than something else? And within federal reform and within even some of the previous legislation, there's funding to start looking at that and to do comparative effectiveness, to not just say, yes, this pill does work. Yes, it will cure, you know, whatever ails you. But does it work better than anything else that's on the market? And that's the piece that's missing, and we need to embrace that as a society and not be afraid of it.
Thank you, Ms. Gasway, for your testimony. Appreciate
Thank you very
you coming
much for
all this way.
Me.
Next up, could we have Mr. Aaron Crane, Senior Vice President of Operations and CFO from Salem Hospital. Okay. Mr. Crane, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Shields and members of the committee. Thank you for giving me the time to chat with you about this subject today. Appreciate your interest and hope I can help. So I guess I should put this up on the screen. Is that what we're? But I have a. I put together a packet, and I'm just listening to some of your questions. I might try to help with a little bit of that as well from our perspective. So, in case you're not aware, Salem Health is a two-hospital health system based here in Salem. We have a 450-bed medical center here, and we also have a 6-bed critical access hospital out in Dallas. And we do have 77-plus providers in a multi-specialty group, primarily physicians, but also advanced practice nurses. You know, a few volume statistics in terms of size. I thought the committee might be interested in the magnitude of revenue from state contracts. In this past year, we had about $51 million in revenue generated by treating members of PEB, another $20 million from the OEB membership, and then with Medicaid and Oregon Health Plan, almost $40 million in revenue last year. So we do serve a significant population that are under the state's contracts. So in starting talking about cost trends, I guess I wanted to at least put up our operating margin first. So as you start to think about price increases and what's happening there, you'll see in our operating margins that whatever we're doing in pricing isn't translating to excessive profit. Operating margin is a calculation of our operating income, which is revenue minus expenses, divided into our net revenue. And so I put Salem's line up here in the purple line to show us since 2005. And then the red line is actually the Oregon average, which comes from a book the Hospital Association has, I think, put out for the legislative body. And so you'll see, again, we've certainly had peaks and valleys over the past several years, and the state average is running between 3 and 4%. And you could certainly ask the question, well, what's an appropriate margin for a hospital or a health system and all the capital that we have to replenish and the safety and et cetera. And, you know, I'm not necessarily the national expert. Numbers I hear are in the neighborhood of 6 to 8% to really sustain a healthy organization over time. So then I want to come into the price increase. So over that same window, roughly, looking at what Salem Health has done in terms of price increase, and you'll see we float around 6% more often than not. In 2009, we did spike to a 10% increase as we opened a new building and found a need to bring that up a little higher. When we do a price increase, we do study the region. We do track as much as we can. Obviously, with a lot of antitrust laws, you don't just go ask people what they charge. It's a little bit different than that. But we want to make sure that as we do our pricing, we're not falling out of line. And there's a website, OregonPricePoint.org, where you can compare aggregate pricing, and you can see things that kind of help you feel like you're in line. And we've always felt like we're in line or perhaps a little behind the Portland market. We also review Eugene and Corvallis. So that's kind of how our pricing is done. Now, when you talk about this cost shift issue that you were bringing up, what happens is you'll see when you look at our overall pricing, on average it goes up 6% or 10% or whatever the number is. But hospitals look at which payers pay based on charges, because for 50 to 60% of our population, what you raise your price doesn't matter. Medicare and Medicaid are both pretty well set systems. So raising a price on a Medicare patient, it doesn't really gain you anything. So it's almost pointless. So you do look at areas of services that have a higher commercial or a higher revenue-based payment system. So when you raise rates in those areas, you can generate a little bit higher return. So that's the cost shift thing, the jargon that's come up. That's what it really means, is you're really setting your price the same for everybody, but in areas where it has a higher utilization of commercial-based volume, that's where you tend to raise it a little bit more. I have a whole set of lecture on this if you ever want to hear it, but I'll move on today. So looking at that dollar in revenue, there are really two things that consume it, and then what's left is your margin. And so the top kind of left or right of the donut where it says other labor and supplies, those are expenses, and so those are the actual things we're paying out in expense to provide care. Labor is the biggest one at 27 cents on the dollar. Supply is the second biggest at 9. Bad debt and charity is a little different. Charity kind of comes out of revenue. It isn't really an expense, but bad debt is considered an expense. But I group those two together because as you classify bad debt and charity, the line is pretty gray, I guess, between what really is bad debt and what is charity. But then you get to the other side of the donut and you see the adjustments. So these are the amounts that we take out of the gross revenue to get to what we're really paid. And so commercial adjustments are about 5 cents on our dollar, while Medicare is 30 cents and Medicaid is 7. And so these are important things, because as you're talking about pricing and cost shifting, these variables factor in order to make a margin work. So in looking at the major ones, I wanted to show you our compounded annual growth rate in each of these major areas. And so when you look at the expense side of the donut, you've got total expenses on aggregate over the past 5 years trending at about 5.7% per year. And, you know, when you look at standard inflations out there of 2% or so, you can tell clearly healthcare has got a little higher rate of growth than the major, the rest of the economy. Labor, the most significant piece of the donut, has gone up about 3.5% over the past 5 years. And these are adjusted for volume. So I've looked at our total costs and I've looked at our total volume, so that while there is certainly growth related to doing more procedures or adding patients, this factors that out and just looks at the pure inflationary aspects. So then you get over to the bad debt at 11%. That's really gone up quite a bit. And, of course, Oregon's had economic issues over the past 3 or 4 years, certainly, and that has contributed to this. But Medicare...
Mr. Chair?
Senator Monroe.
That bad debt, is that primarily people that don't have insurance and they go to the ER for treatment and they can't afford to pay?
It is, Mr. Chairman and Senator Monroe, it is a... several things. There are people. It is the individual liability. So what a person is actually paying versus their insurance company. But there, in most every, just about everybody who comes to our door has some personal liability. They'll have insurance and they'll have a piece that they owe. And we find that a chunk of it certainly comes out of people who have insurance, because there are people kind of hovering that have insurance and still don't have the ability to pay. And there certainly is a lot of it who come to, for care that don't have any insurance at all, and their primary point of access is through the emergency department. That's not the only point, but that is certainly an area of that. I would say that when we look at our charges for people without insurance, the average payment is about 3%. So they're not, most of the people who are uninsured, on the aggregate, we're getting about 3 cents on the dollar in collection. So it is that they're not paying a huge chunk, and that's part of our mission, so it's not something I'm complaining about, but that is what it is. So the point I guess I wanted to make here is the Medicare and Medicaid, this adjustment thing is raising at a rate far faster than our expenses. And so when you talk about the cost shifting as one of the mechanisms that you use to offset that's one of the key drivers. So on the total expenses at 5.7%, I showed labor and supplies because they're the biggest pieces of the donut, but there are things that are smaller in total but are growing at a far faster rate, and I thought I would just mention a couple of those real quickly. First of all, one of the big ones is clinical information systems. There's a significant demand out there for healthcare to become electronic. Electronic health records, people want to access their information online. You want to be able to share information from a variety of physician settings depending on when you need it to care for the patient, and that's a very significant investment. And for us, when you look at the beginning of this in 2006 to where we are today, that has grown substantially, about 235%. In terms of that 5.7%, it's probably, you know, about maybe 15 to 20% of that increase. And of course, our building, a lot of hospitals are aged, and there's a lot of construction that's gone on over the past 5 or 6 years to replace facilities, and that's also been a pretty significant number, and it's grown at a cost of about, or a compounded growth rate of about 13%. And finally, professional fees. You'll find, I think, and the physicians can certainly talk about this, but physicians, as they're making their time of most use to them, we're finding more and more practicing in an outpatient setting in the primary care area and not in the inpatient setting. And so we've had to invest in hospitalist programs and in other kinds of coverage to make sure our patients can get the care they need and our physicians can really leverage their time the most effectively. And so we have invested a lot in those kinds of things, as well as our trauma program and having surgical on call. So that's grown about 17% a year, just trying to keep pace with those trends.
Can we finish with
sure.
the presentation?
Yeah, I think there's just
some questions.
Two more slides, I'm
okay.
sorry. So I wanted to come back to the commercial adjustments, which went the wrong way. And so this shows our discounts and how they've gone, and commercial is the green line, and Medicaid is red, and Medicare is purple. So Medicare is clearly the largest in terms of adjustment, and commercial has been the smallest. But over to the right, I'm showing the compounded annual growth rates here. In commercial, the rate of increase of adjustments is by far the largest at about 18%. And what that is really saying is the market pressure on hospitals in terms of really capturing more in terms of price increases definitely intensifying, and we're seeing less return on that. And I think that's appropriate. I mean, the market is really getting to a place where healthcare, we need to do something different in order to manage this. And then the last thing I guess I wanted to point out is we're trying to think about the cost, the contributors to healthcare cost. I wanted to put this slide up. This is information from the sources noted around what are the contributors to length and quality of life, what really is impacting our health and our ability to live long and quality lives. And the healthcare delivery system is about 10% of that in terms of contribution. And really the largest is behavioral. The 40% of behavioral attributes that impact our lives is really something that needs to be paid attention to, and gets back to how the system is utilized and what choices people are making that then impact, that cause them to seek health care and utilize services that may have been otherwise avoided, or certainly to a lesser degree. So I will stop there. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Crane. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Crane, you talked about the increased cost for things like electronic medical records going up 235%. Mm-hmm. But at least part of the reason for electronic medical records is cost savings. So at what point do you anticipate that there will be a savings from having the electronic system?
Chairman Shields, Senator Bonamici, absolutely we expect some savings in this. The ability for people to adapt to technology, that's pretty, I'd love to say it was immediate, but it takes time for people to learn how to use these systems, and it's not fully done. I mean, we're taking a healthcare system that has used so many different information systems and trying to put them all into one so you have all the clinical information, whether it's a lab result, an imaging study, or what happened in the ER last week. Getting all that information together, getting physicians used to being able to access it, getting our people capable entering it in, it's taking a fair amount of time. We've certainly improved. What we've seen here is with medication administration, we've improved safety dramatically. One of the first in the country to actually use the system to barcode the drug, the patient, the nurse, and compare that to the order to make sure they're getting the right amount, the right dose at the right time. It's incredibly safer. And when we first did that, it took people time. It was cumbersome. And I think the process has worked its way out. And but there's, you know, just like that one thing, there are hundreds of those kinds of things that people have to be able to become more adept at. And we just went live with the physician order entry component of that last February, and so that is working its way through. And you know, I can't point to everything right off the top of my head, but clearly we expect some savings, but there is a bit of a learning curve to it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator George.
I missed, thank you, Mr. Chair. I missed misunderstood a little bit of your presentation when you had the slide that talked about your revenue and you have adjustments, Medicare adjustments. So are you saying you set a price to do this procedure, it's this price, and then Medicare or the insurance companies come in and say, yeah, but we're only willing to pay this price. So you guys book it in at your sticker price, but then what you actually get paid is a lower price, and then you're including that adjustment? Is that what you're... Is that what that slide was explaining?
Chairman Shield, Senator George. I didn't quite complete this story here.
Okay.
And so there is certainly a Medicare program requirement that we charge everybody exactly the same. So when we raise our prices, our charge is the same for everybody. There isn't a regulation in terms of what you contractually agree to. So you can go to the Medicare program or the Medicaid program and accept less than what you charge for that program. That's acceptable, so that's what has happened. We will have contracts, and then if you don't have a contract, you're obligated for full charges. But virtually every insurance plan has some kind of an agreement with us, and it's usually for something less than charges. But they are different, each insurance company, and there could be different reasons, whether it's how they communicate with you, what their claims denial, their administrative process is, the volume of patients. You know, there are lots of factors that go into negotiating a contract, but they do, at the end of the day, have different rates on a net payment basis. And we...
Deducted from your revenue.
That is deducted from that gross charge, and that's what those adjustments we're referring to. That's the amounts that are deducted to...
And it book in the total revenue,
right,
sticker price, and then you back up.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. That's excellent.
And just a couple of quick questions.
Sure.
Mr. Crane, Salem would be considered one of these must-have hospitals. You're the only hospital in Salem, is that right?
Correct.
And so in the individual and small group markets, in individual probably seeing on average 17-18% premium increases per year for the last 4 years, small group maybe 12-14% premium increases. It would seem like, you know, you would be one of those must-have hospitals. I think the AAP presenter, Ms. Gaswade, talked about one hospital getting reimbursement increases of 40%. Could you tell me what your experience has been in your reimbursement increases in the last year?
Yeah, Senator Shields, sure. We, with our... couple of things here. First of all, to individuals who come for care, we already, by policy, they don't pay more than our insurance companies pay, so we don't charge an individual without insurance. And like I said before, they rarely pay more than about 3%, but we don't, by practice, we give them a discount consistent with our insurance practice. But within the insurances, so pick any of them, you know, Regents, whatever, with a big insurance company, we negotiate a contract for commercial care, and we don't negotiate the small individual plan versus the big company plan. We just negotiate a contract with them, and then they access that contract via all their other plans. So we don't necessarily say with the individual plan you're going to pay us more than you are with your group plan.
Right.
So that's their decision. And typically, you know, I'm bound by confidentiality in these agreements about specific terms, but I can tell you they all have a cap about how much you can raise your price. And so when you look at our 6-8%, you know, that's factored into our negotiations with them. And so we're not raising someone else something more than what you saw on the screen.
So you're saying about 6-8% is
correct.
What you
well,
what,
yeah,
increase
I can,
per year. That's okay. I saw the slide.
Yeah,
I just wanted
it's
to
the same one. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
I know you're very busy. And let's move on to people who are also very busy stepping away from their patients today, and we really appreciate them coming as well. Could we bring up Dr. Rick, is it Wopat?
Yes.
From the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, please.
Chairman Shields, Vice Chairman George, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify and represent the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians before your committee. Oregon Academy represents over 1,000 members across the state of Oregon. I bet by now you're wondering where all that money went, that all those raises you heard about. I will tell you that it does not go to primary care physicians. And I will talk a little bit about that, but I do appreciate the opportunity. I won't throw out a lot of numbers. I will talk about some concepts. My name is Rick Wopat. I'm a family physician. I've practiced in Lebanon, Oregon for the last 31 plus years. In addition, I've had a privilege of serving the last four Oregon governors on a variety of commissions, including the Health Services Commission, the Health Policy Commission, and currently I am a member of the Medicaid Advisory Committee and subcommittees of the Health Authority. Unfortunately, Ms. Patrick, having staffed some of those committees, can tell you we have listened to many hours of discussion about what drives costs of health care. But in my opinion, it's relatively simple. And there are three main causes. One is we're getting older and sicker. The patients that I see now are much more complex than they were 30 years ago and have many more medications and conditions. The second is that we are enamored with high-cost, high-tech care. We do buy the best of everything, and we like to use it. The third, and I think not least, is that we have a very poorly organized, inefficient healthcare system. Now, I could opine at some length about and present a lot of evidence around the aging and the high-tech issues, but I'll leave that to others and spend my time discussing what I believe is a very poorly organized, inefficient, and in many ways ineffective healthcare system. Currently in this country, if you have a heart attack, you're involved in a car accident, or you have a stroke, you get the best high-tech care, and it's excellent care. It also costs a lot, and the payment system drives the delivery system in this country, and that's why you see a tremendous amount of investment in cancer institutes and cardiac institutes and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, we're not very good at preventing heart disease and strokes and improving health. We have the best cardiologists to treat your heart, the best nephrologists take care of your kidneys, the best neurologists to take care of your brain, but they seldom talk to each other and they seldom address the whole patient. Our current disease-focused, specialist-driven system increases costs, fosters duplication, and does not improve the health of the population we serve. You saw the data on the fact that we're spending approximately 17% of our GNP, and it only affects 10% of the health of our population. One could argue that that, in fact, is costing us in terms of taking money away from schools, infrastructure, public safety. What we lack in this country is a foundation of primary care. For health reform and cost containment to be successful, we must focus on providing more primary care to more people. The data is indisputable, and I can share that data with you at another time if you'd like. More primary care lowers costs, improves longevity, and improves health outcomes. More specialty care, on the other hand, increases costs and in some places does not improve outcomes. Primary care has four functions or characteristics. First is improved access to care and information. The second is that it's person-focused and not disease-focused. And it is lifetime care, not disease-time care. So, as we say in our office, we take care of patients from diapers to Depends. Primary care is comprehensive care, and I think most importantly it provides coordination of care, which is sorely missing and I do believe leads to a lot of increased cost. Good primary care reduces emergency department costs, it reduces urgent care, it reduces hospital days, and it reduces complications. Unfortunately, right now in this country we spend less than 10% of our health care dollars, around 10% or less, on primary care, and spend 90% on specialty care, hospital care, pharmaceuticals, and other items. And that's significantly less than most countries spend in primary care. Barbara Starfield at Johns Hopkins University has studied this for the last 3 years. She's published over 200 articles. I'd be happy to share them if you want at another time. So failure to restructure the current delivery system will simply lead to more demands on a broken system and more costs. If we increase our coverage to an additional 15 to 20% in this country and try to deliver the care in the same way, we're just going to go further down the trail of high costs, high technology, poor outcomes. If we're going to be successful in controlling costs in the future, we must restructure how we deliver care and promote a foundation of primary care that's person-focused and fosters comprehensive and coordinated care. Last, if the committee will allow, I feel compelled to offer one somewhat disjointed comment on a major cost driver. Earlier this week, I saw a young woman weighed 410 pounds. Ooh. I have multiple patients in my office that weigh well over 400 pounds. When I started practice, anybody over 250, 300 pounds was a rarity. Now it is commonplace. And I don't know how to solve that, but I can tell you it costs the hospitals a tremendous amount of money in extra beds, wheelchairs, ceiling lifts. This afternoon, my nurse is making visits on a patient who can't get out of the house. And if we don't address that at some point, it's continuing to get worse. So with that, I thank you for listening to my thoughts, and I'm more than happy to answer questions.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wopat. Really appreciate your remarks. The last point you made is, I think everybody on the committee understands the importance of that. It's a very difficult thing to legislate, however, as you know. But my question has to do with, what's your opinion about why people now going through medical school go to specialties instead of to primary care? Is it because of the salary or because of prestige or it's more interesting? Or what? Why are there so many specialists now and fewer people going to primary care?
The payment system drives the delivery system. And I think that, you know, my son is a third-year medical student at USC. He is borrowing over $250,000 to go to medical school. When he finishes, he would like to go into primary care, but that's like taking out a mortgage before he gets out of medical school, and he'll be paying. That's 2 to 3 times the average starting salary of what a primary care would be. Now, if he goes into orthopedics or urology or dermatology or any of those subspecialties, he would be able to pay that off more quickly. I do believe that there are lots of young individuals who have go into medical school with high ideals of doing primary care. They feel burdened by a huge debt, and they see that the easy way out of that is to go into a specialty. That said, I expect and I hope that the system is going to change as we recognize the importance of primary care. I believe as a primary care physician, I am very well paid. I think that the way we finance education in this country is unfortunate and leads to those kind of consequences.
Thank you.
Dr. Wopek, I'll ask you the same question that I asked the previous witness. You're practicing in Lebanon. I assume there's not, you know, thousands of primary care providers in Lebanon. So you must have some pretty good negotiating capacity with the insurance companies. We've been seeing, you know, 14% to 17% premium increases in the small group and individual markets. Can you talk about what the increases in your reimbursement rates from the private payers has been over the last year or so?
Senator Shields, the increase in terms of primary care has been very small. Certainly not more than 5%. And the difficulty that we have is that we have an increasing debt burden in terms of Medicaid. The Medicaid population in Linn County has almost doubled in the last 2 years because of the economy, and an increased number of uninsured, and we take care of all the uninsured. So what it does is it creates a real squeeze for us. We do try, as an organization, to negotiate higher rates with insurance companies. We, as a hospital in Lebanon, are lucky enough to be a critical access hospital, which allows us to earn extra dollars from Medicare that helps to offset some of those things. We certainly don't see a lot of
income from commercially insured. Last year, 95% of the births at Lebanon Hospital were Medicaid. So we're not reaping the benefits of significant rate increases.
Thank you very much.
One last question. Is your practice part of a hospital system? Is that what you said?
Correct. I'm Samaritan Health. Is when I started practice in Oregon, in Lebanon, there were 7 private practices. In the late 80s, early 90s, we consolidated into a group with the hospital in order to be able to negotiate with private insurance companies as a group. We subsequently have organized with Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis, Albany General Hospital, and North Lincoln and Newport Hospital, and the organization employs about 300 physicians, but we provide care to all of those in the region, including those with no insurance, and we have an all-comers policy, meaning we take all Medicaid and Medicare.
Thank you for that. So what I hear you saying is part of what drove consolidation was the poor reimbursement rates. You had to come together to negotiate better rates.
I would say what drove consolidation from my perspective was that we were better able to serve the region in cooperation than we were in competition. And that allowed us to, whether we've been able to negotiate better rates or not, I don't sit at that table. The numbers, I get kind of glazed over when they keep throwing the numbers out. But I have sat at that table. I do know that our profit margin as an organization has been under 3% for the last several years, and we're just able to make enough to take care of everyone.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Shields.
And by the way, we will have public testimony at the end. If there's the sign-up sheet over there on the side table, if you've planned to give public testimony and have not signed up, please do so. Next up, we will bring Linda Morley, who is a pediatric nurse practitioner, who will present nurse practitioner's point of view on this topic.
Thank you.
Ms. Morley, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Shields and members of the committee. I should clarify, I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner. My grandchildren would like me to be a pediatric. I just know how to do the hugs and kisses part of pediatrics. I'm privileged to be here today and be able to present testimony about something that is very important to me. For the record, my name is Linda Morley. I'm a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. I own a small business. I have a private practice on 12th Street South in Salem. It's my privilege to provide information on trends and costs related to reimbursement for services provided by nurse practitioners in the state of Oregon. And I also want to mention that I am very grateful to the people who have testified ahead of me, because they've already explained a lot of things that now I will not need to explain, such as write-offs. So what is a nurse practitioner? A nurse practitioner is a registered nurse who then goes on to get advanced degrees in education. In the state of Oregon, we are empowered by Oregon statute to be able to practice independently. What this means is that we don't have a physician who is supervising us. Many of my colleagues practice very much like a general practitioner would. My practice is actually pretty much the same as some of my psychiatrist MD colleagues. So I have to say this has been a great benefit, I think, for providing access to care in the state of Oregon. Nurse practitioners work in every area of medicine. Even a couple of weeks ago, my dad had a knee replacement surgery at Salem Hospital. It went beautifully. The person who followed him was a nurse practitioner who assisted in the surgery. Nurse practitioners work in all settings. They hold professorships in medical universities. They work in corrections, public and private hospitals, addiction treatment programs, community mental health programs, work as corporate consultants, and of course private practices, and that's just to name a few. One of the things that makes me very grateful for the education that I have is that nurses are educated on the importance of prevention and wellness and patient education from day one. All of the things that are now being espoused as very critical to helping to control costs, we have been learning for decades now. So this has placed us in a wonderful position, and I believe that our patients really see the benefit of that. Nurse practitioners in the state of Oregon are qualified to diagnose and treat disorders, both mental health and physical health disorders, just as physicians are. As far as the type of practice that I have and many of my colleagues who are in private practice, again, we work very much as psychiatrists do. We see the same type of patients. We consult back and forth. Psychiatrists consult with me, surprisingly. I consult with them. I frequently receive calls from general practitioners, women's health physicians and so forth, calling me to ask me for advice about a particular patient, maybe what to do with their medication. I've been a nurse for over 37 years, and I graduated when I was 5. Early in my nursing career as a registered nurse, I worked in Africa for several years in a very remote area. I was the primary health care provider for a population of about 11,000. I was very pleased to hear the question earlier on medications, because some of the name brand medications here in this country, I could get for $5 or $10 for the entire bottle in the middle of the bush in Africa. This is a huge soapbox issue for me, so I was grateful to hear that. I have also worked in Marion County Mental Health and in the Marion County Jail. At one time, I put together a training for members of the Marion County Sheriff's Department on dealing with people with mental illnesses. I've worked in inpatient drug and alcohol detox. I have been a preceptor for nursing students. In the 1980s, I helped to develop a community-based mental health program at the time that OSH was being emptied out. I currently teach stress management for the Department of Human Services to foster parents. I've had a successful private practice for over 17 years. I also volunteer to provide free psychiatric services at Salem Free Medical Clinic. Many of my patients are recently released inmates from correctional facilities here in Salem who've been given 1 week of medication. And so what I am beginning to see is that we're actually saving a lot of money for the state and so forth in correction costs, in policing costs, and in cost to the state hospital, because we're able to keep people on medication. I have a broad view because of this of the trends that we're seeing in particularly in mental health service delivery, but as well as the private and public costs of mental illness. So this afternoon I'd like to address trends that are of concern not only for me but also for my patients. And primarily, I'd like to address the impact of cuts in reimbursements to nurse practitioners within the past 2 years. In the past 2 years, there has been a significant reduction in income for nurse practitioners. Last year, September 1st, I saw over a 20% reduction in income. As of January 1st of this year, my income went down. From one insurance company went down another 30%. 40% of my practice is with the insured of that particular company. Yesterday, one of my clients, who's a clinical social worker, or not one of my clients, he's a colleague. He'd like to hear that he was a client. But anyway, a colleague told me that his reimbursement rate from one particular insurance company fell by 35% within the last year. He is also insured by that same company. His family is. Their premiums went up by 20%. We are not seeing this. The same thing has happened in my family. We are insured by a different insurance company. I am on the panel of that company. My rates went down by close to 50%, my reimbursement, and we had to, and our premiums were increased. So some of the things that we're seeing as far as small business owners, we're finding that other health care providers are receiving higher reimbursement for similar services to what we are providing. The nurse practitioner I see every year for my annual exam is reimbursed three times the amount that I am for equivalent service and equivalent time. Unfortunately, for some reason, in the field of mental health, psychiatric nurse practitioners are reimbursed at the same rate as licensed clinical social workers and master's level practitioners. And yet we're medical practitioners. We have large malpractice insurance premiums and many other kinds of expenses and liabilities that they do not have. One of the things that we're seeing is a large amount of attrition, and I have to tell you, I am very, very concerned about that. Part of the attrition is simply through retirement. In this area, in the Marion County area, I would say probably the majority of my colleagues will be retiring within 5 to 10 years. Because of what's happening with reimbursement rates for psychiatric nurse practitioners, there is little incentive for nurses to go on and, again, as has been discussed already, to incur the extra expense of education. I have several patients who are registered nurses at Salem Hospital. They make more money than I do. Plus, they have benefits. In one of the things that we notice also that is a discrepancy is that most regular medical providers have office staff. They have people who do their billing. They have people who are receptionists. We are not able to afford that. I am not aware of any psych nurse practitioners in this area, to my knowledge, who have office staff, other than someone that we may hire on an hourly basis to do billing and so forth. Another huge concern for me is impact on patients. As this attrition begins to occur, you know, we already know, we see on a regular basis on the nightly news the impact of mental health concerns on the public, on health care, and so forth. In fact, I looked up a little bit of data, and one of the things that we find is that 75% of the visits to doctors' offices concern stress-related ailments. And I receive referrals all the time from other medical practitioners because of this very thing. One of the things that I found in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine is that untreated and mistreated mental illness cost the United States $150 billion in lost productivity and $8 billion in crime and welfare expenditures. I think I might actually put that second one a little higher based on my experience with the criminal population. For employers, an organization called Partnership for Workplace Mental Health and Substance Use Disorders cost employers an estimated $80 to $100 billion in indirect costs alone. So patients, one trend that I'm seeing is that many nurse practitioners are leaving insurance panels because of, not only because of low reimbursement rates, because of difficulty receiving payments in the first place. My adult daughter is the hourly person who works for me. She's actually my boss, and she is responsible for scheduling, getting payments, and so forth. In the last 2 weeks, she has spent approximately 4 hours on the phone with one particular insurance company trying to get reimbursements for 4 visits that we had last year. And here's the problem. The insurance company discovered that this woman saw a therapist the same day that she saw me to get her antidepressant. The insurance company will not pay for two mental health services on the same day. I've heard of this before because I've been doing this for a long time. Not all insurance companies do this. My daughter was incensed. I had to calm her down. She couldn't believe it. Now, here's the problem with that. Because, of course, the thing that I've always done in the past is we'll just schedule her on another day. My practice is in South Salem. This woman lives on the other side of Wilhelmina. Her husband is unemployed. She has two preschool-aged children. And her insurance company will not pay for her to get two services on one day. Her therapist's office door is 20 feet from my office door. Some things are very broken about our system. We will not be able to receive reimbursement for those services that I have already provided. I believe it's about $400 worth. In 2009, you know, I was so grateful to hear the talk already about write-offs, you know, that we have a certain fee that we charge, it gets charged to everyone, but then we have contracts with individual insurance companies who all will reimburse at a different rate. And so on the average, in 2009, there was an amount, I don't recall now what it was, that I wrote off. In 2010, I wrote off three times the amount that I wrote off in 2009 because of a decrease in reimbursement rates. My reimbursement rates currently for some companies is about what I was being reimbursed when I went into private practice in the mid-1990s. So one of the impacts on patients is that nurse practitioners are leaving provider panels because of some of these issues. On today's Wednesday, on Monday, I heard that one of my colleagues, who is a member of many panels who has hundreds of patients, has decided to leave all of the panels. She's sending out a letter to her patients telling them that, unfortunately, she will now only be able to work on a cash-only basis. This means the patient will pay full fee up front, and then the patient, who may be vegetatively depressed or have real challenges cognitively and already have difficulty brushing their teeth, let alone trying to figure out how to get reimbursement from an insurance company. The thing that will happen with her patients either is that they will find a way to try to pay that, or they will search for another provider. I might be one of those providers. The average wait time for someone to get in to see a nurse practitioner in this area, a psychiatric nurse practitioner, is 1 to 3 months if you're suicidal. Physicians, psychiatrists, are not taking new patients currently. I talked to the office manager yesterday at the largest practice of psychiatrists here in town. So you can imagine how distressing this is for families who are trying to deal with a family member who might be dangerous, who might be suicidal. Now, here's another thing that happens with health care costs. These people either don't get help or they go to the emergency room. It's expensive to go to the emergency room. Some of them end up in the county jail. And, of course, Salem Hospital and our corrections budget is eating up a lot of this. If nurse practitioners were reimbursed at a more reasonable rate, there would be more of us, and we would be seeing more people before they get to that stage.
Ms. Morley, this has been great testimony. I thank you so much, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to move you along, because we've got other people that we still have to hear from. Would you like to take a moment or two to make a summation?
You know, I'm about at the end already. I want to say I'm very grateful. Thank you all so much. I appreciate having been invited. Thank you, Senator.
And we really appreciate your testimony. colleagues, I will use the prerogative of the chair to move on to the next testimony. We have Sean Colmer, Deputy Administrator for the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, who's just going to talk to us a little bit about the All Claims database that can help us get to some of the questions that you've asked about as far as reimbursement and how we can find out how some people are reimbursing versus others. Concision is much appreciated.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Deputy Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research in the Oregon Health Authority. Okay, that's out. So what I want to talk with you a little bit about today is Senator Shields and I have had a couple of conversations about the information that we get as an office and also a system that's going to be coming online soon that I think will help address some of these questions that you're having. So I'll go through this quickly and then entertain any questions you might have. I think... So just as a little brief, since this is probably the first time we've presented, I know at least during this legislative session, but for others, for who we are, inside the Oregon Health Authority. We are a policy advising office to the governor, you all, the Oregon Health Policy Board, and many, many other governor-appointed commissions, as Dr. Wolpat mentioned, the Health Services Commission being one of them, another being the Medicaid Advisory Committee. So a lot of the staff work and thinking about around those groups at least happens to some degree in our office. We're also heavily involved in the health system transformation team that the governor has pulled together over the last couple of weeks. This is the kind of work that we do. We do not only policy-level work, but we also do some analytic work. We have a significant amount of authority on the healthcare delivery system to provide information, to provide data, so we can help you answer some of the questions that you might have. For example, we've had a long-standing reporting system around hospitals, around financials and utilization. We've also had a program that was mentioned earlier today that Senator George perked up about around patient hospital costs. It's been a collaboration with DCBS over the last couple of years. So we have a lot of those types of things that we have in our office. Most of them lead to public reporting to some degree. Some of them don't. Some of them are really for policy analysis, but most of them have a public transparency component to them. So this is, I think, why I'm here, is this sort of age-old question that I think you all are now grappling with and trying to figure out is, where are the costs? Where are they going? How are they going? What are the differences? What are the variations? And as part of that conversation in the 2009 legislature, you all and others were asking those same questions. How do we get to a place where we can see the system? We can have a transparent system so we can make some choices using some information. And that led to our office and the health authority getting what's affectionately termed as the All-Payer, All-Claims database. And I'll talk a little bit about what that actually will do. So what it includes is a couple of things. Claims from medical, pharmacy, also includes health plan member demographics, health plan provider information, and any other pharmacy or dental files that accompany sort of the regular administrative transactions between payers and providers. We have statutory authority over licensed health insurers in the state on all of their lines of business. Third-party administrators, I'd say we have authority over the public payers, but that's not really true. The Medicaid program is inside the health authority, so that's part of our family, so that's how we're going to get that kind of information. And we've also had very productive conversations with CMS about Medicare data, because as you've heard from a lot of the panelists here, Medicare plays a big part in how Oregon's system works, and so we need to have information about Medicare as well to talk about how costs are being either shifted or what the cost variation is in communities. This is the kind of information that will be there. The first piece is payments. So what is a hospital? What are we paying for a service? You heard a couple of examples already today about sort of that variation, and that's part of what this database will help us answer is what is that variation between the same service and who's getting paid what, and how do we understand what that variation means? Does that variation mean someone's just negotiating a better deal, which is okay, or does it mean they're providing better quality, which is okay, or is there no difference in quality and there's just a huge price variation? We'll also be able to understand member financial responsibility. Coverage isn't the only answer, because as we've heard earlier, there are co-pays and deductibles that are raising even if people still have coverage, so it's still deterring people from getting the kind of care we want them to get, primarily primary care. Patient demographics, sort of who are we talking about? What do the pools look like? Who are the commercially covered versus who's in Medicaid, who's in Medicare? Is there variation by region? We know intuitively there is, but now we'll at least have some information to really tell that story. Diagnosis, what are people in getting services for? Are they getting services for specialty care, or are they getting services around primary care? What are those drivers, and what are those conditions that are driving the costs specifically in Oregon? There's been a lot of great data and a lot of great discussion nationally about what's happening nationally, but what does that look like in Oregon, and how does it look different from a state perspective versus some regional perspectives? Procedures, types of bills, where are people getting services? Are they getting services in the emergency department? Are they getting services in a primary care clinic? Are they getting services in X clinic? Are they getting services nowhere? Sort of where people are going for the types of services they're getting. We're not the only ones doing this kind of thing at the state level, although I'd say we're on sort of the front end of the wave of this. I think this is part of many states' conversations to understand what's happening in their own system. The first problem that many states have, including our state, is, well, where's the data? Help us understand what's happening in the system so we can make informed choices. A lot of these systems are built around transparency, and that's no different than our statutory obligation for this program. Not only are we about transparency and obligated around transparency, but also around healthcare reform. How do we provide a data system that will inform you all and your decisions, other policymakers? How do we make sure we have a system that will allow us to evaluate changes that we make? And how will that help us in moving the work forward? Here are some of the strengths of this program. I think one of the key things to think about is, the people who have their fingers in the entire system are the payers. And so the great thing about this system is it leverages existing systems, administrative systems, and touches the people or the system that has their fingers everywhere. Instead of talking to individual providers or individual hospitals, we are going to be reaching out to the payer community, which for our estimates are about 50, and we're going to have information essentially about the healthcare system in Oregon. Just as a little bit of context, there are 58 hospitals in the state that we currently have authority over to get data from. So instead of only having a hospital piece asking 58 people, asking 50, we're going to have a view of the whole system, both an inpatient, outpatient, and pharmacy setting. I think I've already hit these points. I don't necessarily want to beat a dead horse on this one and allow some time for you all to ask me some questions you might have about this system and others. But I'd also be more than happy, Senator George, to talk about some of the questions you had earlier. So.
And Sean, we do have four more people who need to testify, so if you could.
I'm done.
Beautiful. So I think, basically, we'll be able to get information on who's paying what, whether it's, how much procedure, is it OHSU, Providence, Legacy, et cetera, right?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, currently you can do that on a hospital basis. I think that was the first presenter was mentioning data that they used from our site that creates a transparent process where consumers or anybody for that matter can go up and look at what's the price differential between childbirth, as an example, between hospitals. That's already available from a commercial perspective. It doesn't get at Senator George's questions about Medicaid and Medicare, but it does around commercial.
And between insurers as well? I could look up what Regents is paying at OHSU versus what Providence is paying at OHSU.
Chair Shields, one of the things in our statute around this all-payer outcomes database is around trade secrets. And we're having conversations with DOJ about what that actually means, because it wasn't terribly clear. So we're having those conversations with DOJ and also with stakeholders about what that means.
Okay. Question? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, appreciate it, Sean. All right, we have four people who are presenting. I know one is from 100 miles from this meeting. So could we bring forward Dr. Kevin Wilson, please?
Good afternoon.
Welcome,
Chair George. Thank you. Members of the committee. My name's Kevin Wilson. I'm a naturopathic doctor. I've been in practice for over 27 years. I practice in Hillsboro, Oregon, and live in Forest Grove. And I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians as well as myself. I really appreciate the prior testimony, especially Dr. Wopat, because naturopathic doctors are primary care physicians as well in Oregon. And I want to make the key point that I think one of the drivers for the cost of healthcare is that we are not fully utilized by the state, and our services are restricted by some of the insurance companies' policies, obfuscating or obscuring people's access to us by a various number of ways. And I think that's key. The state licenses us with a full scope of practice, but insurance companies often will determine whether or not there's a dollar figure that limits our care, or there is a few number of visits, or we cannot do diagnostic procedures or whatever. And this ends up driving our patients into redundant services by having to go to a medical doctor or a osteopathic physician or a specialist when we indeed are licensed, trained, and able to take care of those patients. So there's this unusual and unnecessary redundancy of work done. So I think that's a huge thing. As just a practitioner, I encounter all the same frustrations with insurance companies, making it incredibly difficult to either collect or to explain why I'm being paid what I'm being paid. And it takes a lot of man hours to clarify bills and payments. I think Dr. Wopat made a very marvelous point about our citizenry being older and more ill than they used to be, and it takes more work to get them well. But what I think we're missing is that naturopathic medicine has always espoused wellness, lifestyle, and diet as a way to minimize health care costs, and that's being vindicated more and more. We've been around for over 100 years, and it's nice to see our points validated, but we're still not being utilized as best we could for the public. For example, I was trained in chelation therapy years ago as a way to help treat cardiovascular disease, amongst other things. In that training, which was by medical doctors primarily, they emphasized the fact that in the United States, we do over four times the number of invasive procedures for cardiovascular disease, whether it's bypass surgery or angioplasty, et cetera, compared to other Western civilizations or countries where they emphasize more medication or lifestyle and diet to control those very same things, which would be far less expensive. If I could have access to all the people who would like to come to me, I would I believe that I could reduce the cost to the system overall and improve their health and well-being without those invasive procedures. I, too, have to accept reductions in services to be included in many healthcare panels. I have to accept a reduction in fees to have access to those patients or for them to have access to me. And I feel like that is not particularly fair because I actually am an asset to the system overall. And I just would like to see us have a more fair playing field for access to patients. And I think I'll keep it at that unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. Any questions from the committee? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Can we have Dr. Lori Queen up next?
Good afternoon, Vice Chair George, members of the committee. I am Dr. Lori Queen. I'm a psychologist. I'm here representing the Oregon Psychological Association. With the OPA, I serve as the chair of the Professional Affairs Committee. For quite some time, we've been fielding a lot of concerns from psychologists regarding the reimbursement rates and how those have affected us, primarily those of us in private practice. In-network rates, I can tell you, have generally not increased in the past decade. If anything, they've increased only very minimally. Last year, actually, one of the major ones decreased their reimbursement rates by an average of 20%. Most psychologists that we've talked to have questioned whether or not that means they should leave the network. So this brings in another question that I've heard a lot of things that affect us previously addressed. This is one that I think as private practitioners in psychology, we question a little bit more, and that's whether or not to be in or out of network. The question about whether or not leaving networks that's come up has been primarily because of the reimbursement rate reductions, keeping in mind that for outpatient practitioners, time is our commodity. We're working with therapy, which is based on an hourly or 50-minute rate. So it's really hard to work more efficiently because you're pretty much set with the time. So the reimbursement rate is difficult. Also, the amount of time spent in trying to collect claims has been very difficult. So a lot of folks are questioning whether or not they want to stay on networks. The problem with that is that if we leave networks, there may be an issue with getting the referrals, but the other question is that then does decrease access to care. We've got a lot of psychologists in the state, and those who are able to keep a full practice because they're well-recommended, well-respected in the field, and they do good work, those folks keep a full practice, and they don't need to be on the networks, so a lot of the networks are not very attractive in that sense because the rates are much less. What then happens is that those clients that would otherwise be seeing us need to either pay a significantly higher cost for out-of-pocket or they go to see a different practitioner. So one of the problems is that the reimbursement rates are based on what they call the usual and customary rates. I can tell you that the usual and customary rates are anything but. They're a significant reduction based on what we do actually charge, which is a standard in the area. Some of them are about 50% of that. So as you can see, given that time is a commodity, it is not good business practice to actually be on many of the panels. We can't really work harder, so we have to work smarter. And that does make treatment for many clients prohibitive in terms of seeing the people that they do want, particularly if there's a specialty area, whether it be eating disorders, cancer treatment for death and dying issues. There's many different kinds of areas that people, like I say, who have, if they have a special area of expertise, they may not need to be on the panels, which then reduces the access for a lot of these folks. So statistics have shown that certainly mental and emotional disorders have not decreased. If anything, they've increased. One thing that is, to me, very concerning, and I think it's been addressed a couple of different times today, is the prescriptive practices. That what we're seeing is in the statistics is that more patients are seeking medication treatment from their primary care docs or somebody else, but that there's fewer patients seeking psychological treatment. The studies that have looked at obstacles to care were fortunately long past the days of stigma being the issue for mental and emotional care. What we are seeing is that the primary obstacle for care is cost. So transferring the cost of the reimbursement rates onto the patients is not working. We're seeing a lot of people having to drop out of care because they simply can't afford the copay or the co-insurance. So the major message here clearly is that the providers are not benefiting from the rate increases, at least certainly not in the mental health field. Previous people have also commented on the mental and emotional issues that do come out in the workforce. It certainly makes a lot of sense. If we can treat these issues, then we're going to deal with a lot of the other health care costs, whether it be the obesity, whether it be the stress management, all of these factors that really can come back around. A couple other points I want to put out there is that as private practitioners, so this is more on a different note, private practitioners, we have to buy our own individual insurance policies, which are very expensive. I'm in a position of having to do that, and it's not good. It's particularly cutting when most of the policies that I can get as an individual buying a plan don't cover the services that I provide. It's really hard to get a self-pay plan that includes mental health therapy. That's a bite. That's really kind of a cutting piece. And then, again, showing sort of the real-world role of all this stuff is that because of the cuts, my income took a 20% cut last year because of the reimbursement rate drop. I do have a couple of kids, so my choices have not been to work harder or longer. I'm not willing to add on weekends and evenings. So as a result, I am not able to pay into my retirement account this year. So the implications are far-reaching in many different areas, not just for the clients, but also just the consumer aspects of the providers themselves. We're not making more money. So,
thank you, Dr. Queen. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair.
I'll call up Robert Lee, and then we've got one more, Sean Moriarty, after that. And then, colleagues, and we're going to have to introduce some committee bills, all of which I'm sure you will vote for when they come.
Chairman Shields.
Now I'll have to clarify that.
Mr. Lee. Chairman Shields, Vice Chair George, and members of the committee, it's an honor to be able to speak with you today in regards to costs of health care. My name is Robert Lee. I'm presently employed as the Director of Government Affairs and Health Policy Analyst for CARE Medical Equipment. I'm also the President of the Pacific Association of Medical Equipment Services. CARE Medical has been a regional provider of durable medical equipment and rehabilitation equipment for over 40 years, and Paines represents over 100 providers throughout Oregon and Washington, many of whom are small businesses. I'm here today to state my deep concerns over the increased cost of health care and ever-rising insurance premiums. Previous to this current position that I hold, I coordinated over 120 managed care contracts and noticed a very troubling trend. While premiums continued to rise, there was a distinct reduction of utilization of benefits through various means such as increased co-pays, increased deductibles, primarily access issues due to cost. During the same time, basically insurance companies were recording record-breaking profits, and providers were being forced into accepting contracts at severely reduced allowables. Today, many of those suppliers and providers who actually administer the care to patients, such as mental health clinicians, DME suppliers, take your pick, are chronically under-reimbursed, yet are facing further reductions that simply are not feasible, nor are they sustainable, especially for small business practices. Recently, some of the DME providers have been offered take-it-or-leave-it contracts from national insurers, asking for 30 to 40% off. Literally below our acquisition costs. Can't do it. Yet they're finding some provider in Florida who might be doing 1-800 numbers on television to do these products for them. They might drop ship the product, but they don't actually provide the service. They don't provide fitting. They don't hire assistive technology professionals or respiratory therapists to actually make sure that they're meeting the actual supplier standards of conduct to ensure the patient's safety. I'm sure many of you have heard incidences like that. These unsustainable business practices not only affect providers but also threaten the affordability of Oregon small businesses who strive to offer health care for employees. I suspect that this is the future of health care if we cannot contain the costs associated with rising insurance premiums. It is absolutely critical for the future of Oregon that there be some mechanism of enhanced oversight to evaluate and determine the credibility of future insurance premium rate increases to ensure that Oregonians are not being subjected to unnecessary price increases, that healthcare providers are adequately funded, and that profits are not being made on the backs of our least fortunate citizens. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I'm more than willing to answer any questions that any of you might have.
A quick question, if anybody has one. Mr. Lee, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
All right, and we have one more. If anybody else is interested in testifying, Sean Moriarty, please come up. If anyone else is interested, please let me know after him.
Moriarty, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Shields. Thank you for calling me up here for your committee. I'd like to talk with you briefly. I'm the board president of RIPSI, which is Reasonable Insurance Premium Coalition, and I'm also the operating manager at Sesco Inc. in Portland. We specialize in construction equipment, sales, service, and rental in the local Portland environment. What I want to talk to you briefly about is the effects and some of the driving costs that happen on the really on the front lines for small businesses. This year alone, I gave every one of my employees a $50 raise at the beginning of the year per month, and not one of them saw a difference in their paychecks for their take-home pay because of that $50 raise. And that was simply due to the premium, to our premium increases from our insurance provider. Why is that important? In this economy, it's been very, very difficult for, as most small businesses you'll hear from, to, you know, make it in this economy. And watching things, watching your dollars and watching your items or your business very carefully has been at the forefront of managing for my day-to-day activities. In the last 8 years, our rates have actually doubled in cost. To put that in some perspective, I have 30 employees, and if I was to eliminate tomorrow our health insurance for our employees, I could hire 10 people to come in and work for us at an entry-level job. That's huge, and part of the drivers that happen with me on a, or with my employees on a day-to-day basis is we increase the cost for them. To keep that manageable, I have to change rates, or I mean, I have to change policy, our plan to make it affordable for the company to have as for premiums. The effect that that comes down to with increased costs of the procedures, as you've heard from testimony from everybody else, is that there's more out-of-pocket expense. So one primary driver I see just in my body of employees is they're going to wait until they have to go in. They're not going to go in for that early treatment when it's cheaper, you know. Just like any car, you hear a little bit of a knock, you don't do anything about it, the transmission falls out from underneath of it, you got a big expense. But I see my employees doing this on a regular basis is they're holding it, treatment, they're waiting for treatment until they absolutely cannot hold off anymore, and that's generally when they're seeing that their treatment costs are increased. And it's due to higher premiums, higher not only the premium costs costing more, but the utilization of those plans. Driving them to say, maybe I can go tomorrow, maybe I can go next week, and not getting those treatments, not having access to some types of treatment. Oh, I have to go in and I have to go to my primary physician, which is one copay. That gets me a referral to go pay another copay to go see another physician that specializes so that I can get the treatment that I need. It all adds up, and you know, when people haven't seen raises, and in this economy, at least in our industry, kind of a joking thing that goes around is flat is the new up, you know, when it comes to sales. And that's kind of that's a hard pill to swallow when the only the only up we have is the cost of goods and the cost of healthcare. And this year for us it was 16%. When I look and try and figure out what's best for my employees, I want to know what am I buying. You know, I'm going to take a strong look at it, and I need to see the data as to why am I paying 16%. Where is that money going? And I get vague answers. You know, I don't see it clear, concise, and meaningful in the data that I see, whether it's on whether it's from my insurance provider, whether it's from my broker, or whether I look at the rates that are shown on the insurance premiums website. I want to know, why am I paying 16%? I can't pass 16% on to my customers, not in this, especially not in this economy. I know for our vendors, they're not passing on 16% cost to us. They're holding their prices because they know they have to sell their products too in this environment. I would like to see from the insurance companies to have more transparency in what's going on and what's the driving cost behind this, and how can we solve it on one end and make sure that it's fair across the board.
Thank you, Mr. Moriarty, for your testimony.
Any questions?
All right. Kelly, thank you very much for all the testimony that we've heard today. So I'm going to close the informational meeting on the drivers of the cost of health care. And do I need to open a work session for the... Yeah, we're not going
to. That's a list.
Okay.
I'd go ahead and open it.
Okay. I'll open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee measures. Senator George?
Do you want to make a disclaimer? I just
read the list. This is a disclaimer that you are neither in support nor necessarily opposition to these by accepting them as committee bills.
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 213, LC 1747, LC 2770, LC 2979, LC 3312, LC 3342, LC 3343, LC 3562, LC 3744, LC 3795, LC 3821, and LC 3911.
Thank you, Senator George. And to clarify, can we change that motion? Because LC 213 will not be introduced today as a committee bill.
All right.
So
I would amend my motion to eliminate LC 213.
Okay. Senator George moves that the proceeding list of LCs be introduced as committee bills, except LC 213. Is there any discussion?
In the normal disclaimer, Mr. Chair, so my email doesn't light up. phone.
Normal disclaimer, you are not indicating an I vote on this. There will be a time and a place for that down the road. Any further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Anything else for the good of the order? This committee is adjourned. Thank you, everyone, for testifying.